Welcome everyone to Art of Advisory. Today we have a special guest, Edie Osborne, and we'll introduce her in a little bit. And I'd like to introduce my co-host, Kirk Bowman from Art of Value. Hey, Kirk, how are you?
I'm doing good, Hector. How's it going?
Everything's great. Everything's great. Excited about our guest speaker who's anxiously waiting to share some of her knowledge.
So I'm excited that I don't have to carry the content this week.
That's right. That's right. We'll let Edie do all the work. So Edie is the author of a book called Firm Forward, and she has been a crusader in the accounting industry about helping us move to advisory services. I had the pleasure of meeting Edie, okay, in the New York AICPA, where Intuit sponsored or co-sponsored as an experimental nature, sending a bunch of QuickBooks Pro advisors to specialized training about transforming to advisory services. And I met her and her husband who ran the class back then. This was 2010 or 2011, so I was still pretty young in my practice, and she had a real impact on the way I think and just the way I evolved my own practice. And I always had that in the back of my mind. One thing that she said that I think it's amazing, and I find myself thinking about it every single time, which is something that a phrase that she coins called random acts of consulting. And I would like to deep dive into that, because I find myself doing random acts of consulting many, many a times. And then when I think of Edie saying that, I have to step back and go, okay, and I think that the random nature of consulting, it's also a beautiful thing, but it's also very difficult to structure and to charge for and to make sure the client has an appeal for it. Because if the client doesn't know they're being consulted with and it is truly random acts of consulting, then maybe it's not as effective as it should be. So Edie, welcome to the show.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here talking about my favorite topic.
So I like to start with one really important sort of catchphrase that you say, and it's the ethos of a lot of your teachings, is from compliance to reliance. So can you give us an elevator pitch on that?
Well, first of all, I'll say that I'm not an accountant, right? So being on the compliance end of things would not necessarily be something I know a lot about, except that I was married to an accountant for 15 years and tax season widow with four kids. I know what that life is like. We had a bookkeeping practice and a very large tax practice. And, so I got a real sense of what the compliance grind is like. And that marriage didn't last, but the impact of being a tax season widow did. And I went on to start working with the accounting profession. About 1991, I was giving a breakfast CPE, you know, one of those free CPE things. You go and you get lousy eggs in the hotel, but you get your hour CPE and you get to visit with a bunch of other accountants. And we were in the middle of a recession at that point, and people were complaining about their clients not paying the bill, cash flow was tight, and not being an accountant, being a small business turnaround expert at the time, I began to really challenge the assumption that there was nothing that they could do for their clients during a tough economic downturn. And I started to teach them what I call reliance services, where they come to you not for compliance, but for advisory, right? To you'd be the person that they would rely on for the best advice for their business. And so that terminology, compliance to reliance, stuck. And it has sort of been my catchphrase all these years. And what I found in looking at the profession is accountants are really good at accounting for the transactions of the business, but they were missing a huge opportunity to share their accounting skills in a way that was more meaningful to the client. And what I mean by that is to be able to take their accounting skills, their ability to measure things, and not just measure the financial transactions, but all areas of business performance. And my background was marketing consulting, and as I said, a small business turnaround expert. And how I started out was I would go into small businesses and I would design a marketing program for them, and then they would pay me a percentage of the increase that would bring to their business. The problem is nobody was tracking what was happening inside the business. Now, remember, this was long before we had big data. We didn't even have small data at that point, right? This was back in the 90s. And what I found was, in order for me to get paid, I had to help them develop internal performance measurement systems. And so I quickly got up to speed on a balanced scorecard, what that meant, but all of it was geared towards Fortune 100 level companies. And so I began to design a process, a step-by-step advisory protocol that would teach accountants how to take their accounting skill set and combine it with the small business mindset and my unique tool set that I developed for them and become advisors in the process. And so that started our Consulting Accountants Roundtable back in the 90s. That grew into the program that we did for the AICPA, their Performance Measurement Plus program. That was back when they were first starting, about 99, 2000. They were beginning to offer a number of ancillary services to traditional services. And that was going very, very well until the Enron crisis. And then the entire profession went through a major contraction and got refocused on ethics and Sarbanes-Oxley. And that was great for the profession, but it was terrible for our company because all of a sudden nobody was talking about advisory anymore. So we went out on our own again and we began to build our program and we developed a certification around our model, and it's called a Level 5 Service Model. And I won't go into that now. Maybe you'll ask me more about that in a minute. But essentially what I found and what you mentioned in your introduction, Hector, is how important it is to be proactive and to be in front of your clients before they have a problem with, you know, the red flags and the early warnings, rather than just help them clean up the mess after the fact. So going from compliance to reliance includes being much more proactive, to have a systematic approach, to eliminate random acts of consulting. Because how can you charge for something that you've never done before? You don't know what your value proposition is going to be for that service. And so we had to begin to build a bridge between traditional pricing models and value pricing models. We had to develop standardized protocols, which every accountant, I'm looking in your office, your background set up here, I can tell you guys are doing all kinds of cool stuff behind you there, Hector. You guys are doing bookkeeping and tax. And if you're a large CPA firm, you could add audit to that. You wouldn't even think of consider doing that kind of work without some kind of systems or processes in place. And yet, when it comes to advisory work, the one place where the client has the greatest need, we have no systems, no delivery systems, no processes, no protocols, no trainings, no, you know, everybody says, well, those are the soft skills. I'm telling you, they're the harder skills, really. They're not, we talk about soft and hard skills. Soft skills are often, you know, kind of laughed at, that those interpersonal relationship, rapport building, emotional intelligence skills, that everybody wants to kind of give short shrift these days are the skills that are going to make or break the profession in the future. Because it's my opinion, and I think I've got a pretty good perspective on this, having been a witness to it over the last 30 years, is the accounting profession is really good at being accurate, but not always relevant and not always close enough, intimate with their clients' businesses to really be able to identify the issues before they become problems. So compliance to reliance is a broad term, but it encompasses a myriad of internal processes and procedures that make that statement seamless to the client and a great value proposition for both you and the client.
Edie, one of the things that you said that struck me that I want to explore, you might say put some meat on the bones or ask you to do that, is you mentioned, okay, let's go from cleaning up the mess to essentially seeing the early warning signs and being able to say, hey, there's something coming. So instead of going, oh, wow, it's raining outside, going, hey, it's going to rain tomorrow. That's a very simple analogy. And what I'd like to ask you to do is unpack that. Can you contrast those two scenarios, maybe from your experience with a certain type of business, make that a little more practical? So when you say go from cleaning up the mess to, you know, being proactive with the client, what does that look like?
Thank you for asking that. I'll start with a cute little story. It's a little bit of a joke, and the accountants in the audience will appreciate this. This guy's floating in a hot air balloon. He's about 25 feet above the ground, and he looks down and he's lost. He doesn't know where he is, but there's a guy standing down there, and he yells out, hey, where am I? And the guy looks up and he goes, you're about 25 feet above the ground. And the guy in the hot air balloon looks down and says, you must be an accountant. And the guy goes, yeah, wow, how'd you know that? And the guy in the balloon says, because what you told me was absolutely accurate, but totally irrelevant. Right? What I need you to do is tell me not only where I am, right? This is the shift. This is the mindset that's different from your 25 feet. You're accurate, but that's not going to help me to get where I'm going. And so looking at their books and seeing a problem, telling them there's a problem, does not solve the problem. The guy, a great accountant, a good advisor would say, well, you are at, you know, latitude and longitude this, but more to the point, where are you going? Where do you want to go? And let me help you re-navigate your way to that new place. I think of accountants as kind of a GPS for small business, that when somebody has a path they want to get to, that we're in touch with what that path is as the client begins to deal with all the factors in their market, their industry, their customers, their employees, their cash flow, their banking, the economic issues that impact every business owner, their business is going to need to course correct. You know, when we first got those little TomTom navigators in our car, they would talk to us and say, redirecting, right? That's essentially what the role of a great accountant should be for their clients. Where do you want to go? Here you are now. What's it going to take to get from here to there? And maybe you need to plant that balloon on the ground for a few hours and get it refueled. And, you know, you don't have enough fuel to get to where you want to go. So typically what happens is the accountant shows up when the guy is, you know, he's crashed his balloon. Instead of watching, well, where do you want to go? And, okay, you don't seem to have enough fuel to get yourself there. Come on back down. Let's regroup. And then you can head out again. And I'll be your ground crew to make sure that you can fly as high as you want and far as you want to go. So a typical example of this is even something as simple as the chart of accounts. Most accountants give their clients, their business clients, a standard chart of accounts. And that's okay as a starting point, just to begin to create some buckets for income and expenses. But really, when you look at how most chart of accounts are structured, they're structured specifically for tax preparation. They are not structured for management decisions. And so our process is called the level 5 service model. And level 1 are those compliance-oriented services. Those are the traditional foundational services that every accounting firm provides. And we're really good at making them accurate, but not relevant. And the way that we make ourselves more relevant and truly add value, and this is important for every not just CPA, but every bookkeeper, anybody who's involved in touching the chart of accounts or preparing financial statements based on a specific chart of accounts, is to go back through that chart of accounts and look for ways to restructure them so that we can begin to get dashboards specific to specific areas of performance, product lines, service lines, activity centers, so that everyone becomes an intrapreneur in the company because they're getting feedback about how they're performing in relation to what the goals and strategy are of the company. And so by just taking something as easy as looking at the chart of accounts and breaking it out, recategorizing, reclassifying all the different entries in a way that all of a sudden now I can pull a little, you know, a modified P&L for a given department. I can look at what their direct inputs are. I can look at what their outputs are. And all of a sudden that department has its own sort of entrepreneurial feedback loop to be able to course correct on its own. And so when I talk about, you know, most accountants come in and clean up the mess, they don't even clean up the mess. They just tell the client that your house is on fire. They don't show them where the hose is. They don't show them how to turn on the water. They just tell them their house is on fire. And it's, you know, there's a bunch of commercials these days like, oh, you wanted me to fix the problem? I'm just here to monitor the problems, right? I think a lot of accountants have gotten it in their head that independence means detachment. And over the years, working with the AICPA and experts in the profession, they've done a much better job of beginning to define what independence looks like. And as long as we are not making the decisions, the management decisions for the client, anything we can do to improve the quality of information for those decision makers is a value add. And in fact, you know, almost 20 years ago, the AICPA did something called the Vision Project, and they did a, you know, an industry-wide assessment of the future of the profession. And the thing that they said was going to be the most important role for any accountant going forward would be to improve the quality of information for decision makers so that they make better decisions in the moment, not 3 weeks or 8 months after the fact when they finally get their books closed out. So when you're asking about, you know, what is the mess, it can be anything from they can't make payroll, they aren't going to be able to keep up with their loan payments, or they're missing opportunities to expand their company because of how they're focusing their resources. So it's really, it requires a level of business, and I'll use this word very specifically, intimacy, deeper knowledge of our clients' businesses. And for any accountant who has a niche practice, you know how cool it is to know, you know, I do chiropractors, and so I know how chiropractors operate, and I know what a chart of accounts looks like for a chiropractor. You get systems and niches. You start to build some greater efficiencies for your business, right? That's why we like niching, is we become experts and we get better at it, and we systematize our unique intellectual properties around that niche. By adding in advisory to a niche-oriented practice, you now are going to know more, not just about the financial aspects of that industry. You're going to know about the performance aspects of that industry. You're going to know what it takes. What are the key performance indicators, key predictive indicators that are most critical to that business? I'll give you a fun example. This was a story in Inc. magazine, and if you ever want to have fun, just Google Inc. magazine and look, search under their key performance indicators or metrics, and you'll see hundreds and hundreds of stories that they write about this. But this one in particular has stuck with me. A restaurant owner began to notice a particular behavior pattern in his restaurant, and he began to sort of put some numbers to it. And what he discovered is at 8:30 at night, he could go out into his reception area, count the heads waiting to be seated, and essentially know what his gross receipts were for the day. Now, he could call in from Bermuda at 8:30 at night and say, Hector, how many people in the waiting room, and essentially know what his gross receipts are for the day. Now, that doesn't get him to his bottom line, but assuming all other things remain equal, the only variable in his scenario is the number of customers coming through. His costs remain the same. His staff is the same. His costs for food are the same. He gets a pretty good sense. He has a predictive indicator of what's really going to be showing up on his financial information. Most, you know, if you ask a business owner how they measure their profits, they'll get right to the equation, revenue minus expenses equals profits. But what I've discovered, and I think anybody who spends any time really focused on performance measurement will learn, that you measure the revenue minus expenses, but those are the lagging indicators. What we're really looking for, and what the accountants can become very adept at with the right mindset, skill set, and tool set, is that we're looking for the predictive indicators, the leading indicators, not the lagging, but the leading. What are the behaviors, the day-to-day activities that are going to have the greatest impact on our bottom line? And, you know, Jan Carlson wrote the book Moments of Truth, and he talked about turning around Scandinavian Airlines from a massive loss to a massive gain. And he said, we didn't set out to make one thing 1,000% better. We took 1,000 little things and made them 1% better, right? So it's not huge order of magnitude shifts in the business. It's incremental kaizen, or what the Japanese would call continuous improvement kaizen, improvements over time that begins to really crank up the heat of performance in that business. And so where accountants can be involved is helping their clients, one, make sure the information that's going into the financial statements is organized in a way that is far more relevant to the goals and strategy of the business. From that, we can build a business dashboard, something that includes both the financial metrics and the non-financial metrics that are driving the critical behaviors in that business. The level five methodology, you know, is step by step. Level one is that compliance-oriented services, making sure that we're adding value at level one. Level two is financial fluency, making sure that our clients understand what we're showing them. And it's a little embarrassing sometimes to sit with a business owner and ask them after you've handed them the financial statements and say, do you have any questions? And they don't. And we make the assumption that a lot of professionals do that, oh, the client understands their financials. The reality is most small business owners didn't grow up to be accountants. They grew up to be plumbers and contractors and car dealerships and small businesses that don't have the same financial acumen that accountants do. And so we make a lot of assumptions that our clients understand far more than they actually do. So level two is very much about making sure our clients understand their numbers and doing some what-ifing, looking for the lost opportunities from the previous period and saying, well, what if we had collected 3 days sooner? What would that have created for us in terms of cash flow? Or what if we had held our margins instead of letting them slip by a point? What would that have created for us? And anytime you can quantify a lost opportunity cost, you've now opened the door for a value pricing conversation. See, most people are trying to sell advisory services without communicating the value proposition for those services. They just say, hey, I can help you with your business. Sign up, pay me this. You know, whether it's a engagement fee for a one-time project or if it's an ongoing retainer, the problem is we haven't told the client what we're going to be able to deliver to them, right? Tax return, they get a stack of paper. Financial statements, they get a stack of paper. They get the bank, the IRS off their back. We've quantified what that value proposition is, much to people's chagrin. They don't like to pay it, but they do. But when it comes to advisory work, what we have to do is look for the lost opportunities where they're not getting the full bang for their effort, the full bang for their buck, and turn those things around. So a typical small business probably, you know, has 3 or 4 points on their margins that can be cleaned up. They've got opportunities to take advantage with certain clients that, you know, they're A clients that they're not expanding relationships with. Things that if we begin to look at our pricing models different, our service models different, our product models differently, we do a product mix analysis. You know, you may have 10 different products, but only two of them are really making you any money. So then you've got to really look at the overhead associated with the other products and decide, well, are they lost leaders? Do they serve us? Do they not serve us? What have we tested different ways of offering our packaging and our pricing so that we begin to get more data? You know, we create our own big data within the small business environment to make better decisions with. And a better decision today results in a better trajectory for the business tomorrow. And a typical client who's paying an accountant $3,000 to $5,000 in fees for compliance work will easily convert to a $500 to a $5,000 a month client when we're talking about really being involved in their business on an intimate level. So level one is technical foundation, all the compliance work. Level two is financial fluency and what-ifing for the lost opportunities. Level three quickly is discovery and planning. Discovery is where we go in and we really look at those numbers, where we begin to build our own big data for that small business. Once we know where that business is, hey, you're 25 feet above the ground, where do you want to go from here? And so that's the planning piece, where we look at where they want to go, we look at the resources it's going to take to get there, and then we guide them along the way. Level four is once we know where they want to go, we develop a dashboard that monitors the amount of fuel they have and the food they have and the weather that hit them and threw them off course 5 miles. I'm stretching this metaphor a bit, but do you see what I'm saying here? The more we can know where they want to go and what they want to do with their business, the better we can advise them and help them find the data that's going to inform the better decisions for them to move forward towards their goals. And level five is once we have that business dashboard developed, we've got the team involved in the creation of those metrics, they're getting flash reports for their departments, interdepartmental, you know, conversations are happening about how I can help you do your job better, you can help me do my job better. We just find that the internal culture of that organization becomes far more focused on developing processes and procedures that improve the performance of the organization rather than just doing the job. You know, one of my favorite quotes is, I just wish people would come to work each day with a part of their brain that they leave behind. In other words, we come to work to do our jobs, but the smart business owner recognizes that there's a lot of innovation, there's a lot of ideas and new strategies that are sitting in the discretionary part of the brain of our employees that we're not tapping into. We're missing out on the native wisdom of an organization's, you know, culture. And so this process, level five, helps to bring all that to the surface. But it doesn't happen by accident. It happens because a good advisor who's got the right mindset, skill set, and tool set is standing by the side of that business owner, looking at their numbers from a performance perspective, not just a financial or transactional perspective. That was probably a really long answer to a short question, but hopefully I covered some ground that got us to a few more points.
Edie, I guess you've done this before, right?
A few times.
Okay, so I'm going to give you a little bit of rest so you can catch your breath and
good. Regenerate
some saliva. So I like to discuss with Kirk real quick about this. So Kirk and I, we haven't discussed this between the two of us whether or not there is a system in place for consulting. We've shared our ideas and experiences in the process, right, Kirk? We talked about efficiency, we talked about communication, we talked about timing. And there's a part in our hearts and our brains that thinks that this consulting and advisory is random and is fluid and is human and is flawed. And then there's another part of our brain that also loves, you know, the fact that we have some sort of bullet points and guidelines, so at least we don't go off the rails. So, Kirk, do you have any thoughts about that, about having a system in place or systemizing the process of advisory?
So I love that phrase, random acts of consulting. You might ask, well, how do you know it's random? My first thought is, well, did you get paid for it? If you got paid to provide that consulting, then it wasn't so random, okay? Because in my mind, and of course, Edie may define this differently, but in my mind, the random part of it is you're just kind of throwing it out there as you go. There's no intentionality with it. Intentionality implies a process, right? And so I think that's really what we're talking about. Some of the accountants and bookkeepers I've met, actually, they have this knowledge, and I think Edie would probably agree with this. They just are not monetizing it. And of course, the phrase monetize, particularly in the internet space, can be a dirty word. But in this case, accountants really already have the skill set to some degree, some lesser, some more, but they're just not realizing that that's the most valuable thing that they have, and they're giving it away. Essentially, they're giving away the farm. And that's what they need help realizing. I mean, what I heard Edie saying is this idea of going from compliance to relevance. The reason it's about compliance is because they don't care about those numbers. Those numbers for the tax return, all I care about with a tax return as a business owner is, do I owe more money? Okay, very few business owners are going to be getting refunds, okay, if you have a successful business. So the real answer is, you know, how much more do I have to pay, right? And as you know, you and we could take the same kind of line of thinking along other compliance stuff. When you get to relevant stuff, what Edie said was, are you giving them numbers that matter, right? She talked about the restaurant owner who at 8:30 at night, how full is the front room? I can't think of the right room, but anyway, the guest room, right? How full is it? Now we know something. And the more complex the owner's business, the more those metrics may be a little harder to find. Now, sometimes you will have, you know, possibly 2 to 3 leading indicators that are kind of low hanging fruit. But sometimes you got to dig a little bit. I think about down in the Houston area, there's a lot of businesses that provide kind of a combination of kind of custom manufacturing and service type project work. And man, it takes a while to dig into those businesses. They've got an inventory issue. They've got a service component. They also have factors in the field, which could be from the client to the land, to the weather, to the, you know, are they, you know, which part of the geography are they? I mean, all these factors. And so to kind of bring it back, and, you know, I'll let you share anything you might want to tack onto this, Hector, is just this idea that we just got to quit being random about it.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I actually like the fact that you said, you know, how do we know it's random? Because we got paid for it. And obviously that is the most significant way to stake down on the ground that this was a transaction, right? You paid me and I consulted with you. But I like to add to that. Sometimes the client doesn't know they're paying for it. And this is one of the most interesting pieces of our work. When I go to conferences and I speak to other experienced accountants that do say they are in the practice of advisory, but don't charge for it more, don't charge for it explicitly. They just say this is part of the value that I add. And it's this aura of positive value that walks around your work. And if the client doesn't know they're paying for it, even though they are paying for it, it's also random. This is what I mean by that. And I'm a culprit of this, right? I believe I add a lot of value because I am a consultant. But many a times I am just clerking the transaction that the client is bringing forth. You know, they're saying, hey, can you do this tax return? And for whatever reason, because it's in the middle of tax season, it's busy, whatever, I do it. And I make sure I don't just push it and clerk it. I want to add some deep value to it, right? Well, let's talk about planning. You know, are you looking to save money for retirement? Do you have kids in college? Are they going to go to college soon? I do ask a couple of questions. However, in my mind, I'm adding value and I'm charging for it. In other words, I think the premium fee of my services includes that. But when my mindset is not focused on, okay, is this client asking for advisory? Is this client asking for consulting? Is this client welcoming that advice that is purposeful? That the client says, okay, tell me a few things that I'm not just going to listen to them, but I'm going to try to apply them to my thinking. I'm going to try to apply them to my job, and I am going to act upon it, and I'm going to measure the results from it, and I'm going to hold you accountable whether or not it was a good idea or a bad idea, or I'm going to keep leveraging your skills or your third party point of view or whatever your role is as a consultant, because I mean it's still the word consultant and the word advisor. It's just still very broad. I mean, I've had people that I've interacted with very little, like Edie's a person that I've interacted very little. I mean, we spent 2 days together in a training and that's it. I mean, we bumped each other into conferences and I say hello, but we don't interact. But she said one thing that sticks in my mind is always done. And I think I'll die thinking about random acts of consulting. So sometimes we don't know the effect that we're having on people on what we do, because simply we measure it by how deep the interaction was. But the framing of this whole thing is, if you are here to try to get something from me, your mindset needs to be open to that. And I know Edie is not just a great technical person from an advisory standpoint. She's very much an inspirational person. She has TEDx talk, nothing about business, and she does give an homage to accountants, which I love, Edie, by the way. I love hearing any TED speaker that talks about accountants or accountancy. I love, because it doesn't happen. Doesn't happen very often, by the way.
No, it doesn't.
It doesn't. So I wanted to ask you more about, maybe some short, specific things that accountants can do to inspire folks to think about us as advisors, as consultants. Are there maybe a specific set of questions or a specific set of interactions or a specific type of conversation that we have with a client before their ears are open to it? So we're not talking about when the client says, yes, consult me, right? Yeah. No, we're talking about before that. So what is that? What does that conversation look like?
Well, I'm glad you asked the question. And it comes a little bit back to that conversation about random acts of consulting. What does random mean? One of the managing partners who sat in our training went home determined to shift his firm from historical focus to future focus. That was his sort of takeaway from the whole program, is to stop being so historically scorekeeper focused and be more of a coach toward the future. And he said, team, I just want you to, sort of get to know where your clients want to go. And he checked in a month and nothing had changed. No behavior had changed. And so we weren't even happening the way he wanted to. His team wasn't operating the way he wanted to, even randomly. It just wasn't happening. So he began, we said, so let's mechanize this. You know, James Collins wrote the book Good to Great. And he says, what makes companies great? It's not individuals, it's mechanisms, the things that cause people to make better choices. And I'll just reinforce that with one other quote from Buckminster Fuller. And it's my favorite quote. He says, you will never change people's minds. Give them a tool, the use of which will change the way they think about something. And so taking those two concepts what we did was I said, now when do you want them? When do you want them to talk about advisory? When do you want to shift the conversation? And he said, I don't know, every time they meet with a client. And I said, so build it into the engagement process. Make sure that on the audit checklist, you have something there. And what we came up with was a really simple strategy. We said, ask the client for their strategic plan. You can't do a tax return without knowing where they want to go, because if they want to sell in 5 years, that's different from wanting to give it to their kids. All of those different destinations could have an impact on today's tax strategy. When you're doing an audit, where, you know, may I see your strategic plan? We'll give them a context for looking at the numbers to see if they're informing that strategic plan. And so every single compliance engagement they had, they built into the checklist, the system, no more random acts. And they said, may I see your strategic plan? Of course, what came from that is a good number of their clients didn't have one. Those that did were saying, well, why are you asking? Well, we'd like to make sure the numbers that we provide you are more relevant in, you know, the context of where you want to go. The clients that didn't have a strategic plan then realized, well, of course I should. I'm a business owner, but I never got around to it. They hired the firm to start doing strategic plans, which is all part of the level 5 methodology. So just that one thing, may I see your strategic plan? Will you review your strategic goals with me? If they don't have it written down, before I start on anything in your business, I need to understand what your exit strategy is, where you want to go, what's this going to look like. So by shifting the conversation from the past, what's already happened, to the future, that is the first step in advisory. It begins to shift the narrative between you and your clients from just critiquing the past to really building a foundation for how they are going to get to what they want in the future. So that would be one thing. The other is just by asking the client, and this is part of our chart of accounts analysis, and Hector, I'd be happy to give people that tool if you'd like at the end of this. It's one of the tools in our toolkit in our training program, but it's called a chart of accounts analysis, and it basically goes through and is scripted on how to approach the client, how to ask for their, you know, their strategic plan, the things I've already mentioned, but there's one other bit of intel in almost every small business that the accountant seldom ever sees, and that is the secret spreadsheet. And you know what I'm talking about. Every business owner has an Excel spreadsheet that tracks the most critical numbers in their business. They've developed it over time. They pull from different reports that they get, and it all gets compiled into a sort of a very loose version of what we would consider a business dashboard. Do you know what I'm saying, Hector? Every business owner's got that little spreadsheet.
Yeah, I know. The funniest part is when they give it to you and they say, I want you to evaluate this for me. It's like,
yeah,
like trying to understand the secret spreadsheet that contains a million links to a million tabs that calculates, it has these weird calculations and weird metrics. And you're like, where did this whole stuff come from? And it's funny, you mentioned that when you go back and ask anyone, you know, what's the purpose of this number or that number? They don't even recall where it came from. It's like, well, we always look at that number. And as long as that number's over 10, we're fine. You know, and you're like, where all this logic comes from?
So what that business owner is saying to you is, look, Hector, this is how I run my business. He's trying to inform you about what the most critical numbers are. He's asking for you to provide some oversight, not just hindsight, but oversight and insight about what those numbers really mean for him or her. And so I love that your client handed you that. Most of the time, they don't show it to the accountant because they figure the accountant doesn't care about anything outside of the financials. a lot of times those secret spreadsheets form the foundation of a real solid business dashboard. That client has already figured out there are a dozen metrics that are most critical to them. We take those metrics, we pull them out of the spreadsheet, and we put them into a dashboard. So, I mean, basically that client is showing you that there's a value proposition for you to get involved with helping them develop a business dashboard. And the word random, for me, just to kind of really put a fine point on this, is that it's leverageable and it isn't dependent on one person in the firm to deliver it. Not whether you get paid or not, or whether the client paid knows explicitly or it's implied. It's, is it repeatable? Is it leverageable? And is it systematic? Can I say to my junior team member, hey, I want you to go out and do a chart of accounts analysis, and then my senior team member say, it's time to do an inventory of information systems. And my manager, I need you to go to facilitate a financial fluency training. Part of the reason with value pricing that people struggle with it so is the undefined aspect of consulting. There's so many loose ends and different directions you could go. How do you set a price in advance? Our methodology allows for a modularized approach. This is a 4-hour process. We come, we do this with you. The output looks like that. You end up with, for example, something we call the cycle of customer interaction. We go in and we facilitate for 2 hours a map of all the points of contact we have with the customer. We convert each of those points of contact into a critical measure, and then that gets built into a dashboard. We know that that takes 4 hours, and that is $1,500. Or it's $5,000, depending upon the client. Or we do it by department, and it's $3,500 per department. In other words, we have set protocols that we deploy in order to deliver on what we call our, you know, sort of advisory service model. It isn't just one person in the firm who is a consulting savant, which, Hector, you probably are. It's something from the minute I met you, I recognize, yeah, it comes naturally. You sat in our training program and you kind of, yeah, I get this. You have the mindset to see the business from a broader perspective. Where most accountants struggle is they just keep their head focused on the finances only, and they're missing, you know, all the other aspects of the business that could also be measured and managed with the help of the accountant. During the recession, we saw a lot of businesses fail and struggle for lack of a good support around them. And, you know, or we ended up seeing accountants performing random acts of surgery to save a dying business without really having been involved in helping them prevent the problems. So we would put their numbers through a stress test. We would look at their numbers and say, what if you lose your biggest client? What would that look like? What if your margins do slip 5 points? What if you can't get your product at your raw materials at the same cost you did before? Where are the do or die levers in your business during a recession? And let's stress test the business to see what the absolute worst case scenario could look like. And then let's plan for that, because it probably won't happen. But in a down economy, looking at that and planning ahead gives that business owner a sense of control, certainty, which most business owners struggle with day to day. They don't feel like they have any real solid confidence about what's coming down the road. And so there, yeah, random acts of consulting and making sure that our clients really see the lost opportunity cost of not changing their business.
Yeah, thank you for that, Edie. That's great. Let me get Kirk involved in this, because I think it would be interesting to get his take. Kirk is actually a custom software developer, and a lot of the work that he does, it's probably some sort of variation of taking the magic spreadsheet into a system from a software approach. So Kirk, in terms of scoping a consulting job or advisory job, or even pricing the advisory job, or labeling that technical function of moving the secret spreadsheet into a system, which is what you do pretty much, I would say, oversimplified. What are the elements of advisory that affect that interaction from your experience?
Probably the first thing is, number one, the ability of the consultant or the advisor to communicate. I would say number two, the ability or receptiveness of the customer to that communication. That's where it starts. I try in the very first conversation I'm having with a customer to shift it to some type of focus above and beyond the reason they contacted me. In other words, you've heard me use this metaphor many, many times that prescription without diagnosis is malpractice. I don't want to commit malpractice. And so I immediately try to elevate the conversation. You've heard me say this over and over that the customer needs to be able to tell you their self-diagnosis, because in them sharing that with you, they feel heard and it begins to build that rapport. And in this day when we're doing so much business online, either with video or just audio, et cetera, we need to allow that to happen. But at the same time, you need to develop the communication skills as a professional to be able to shift that. And I've gotten to where within a 45-minute conversation, we're probably going to spend at least 30 minutes of that on the higher-end stuff. I don't want to take their prescription. I want to back up and go, well, how did you know there was a problem? What do you think the problem is? What's the effect that problem's having on you? Why do you know that right now is the time to solve the problem? I literally had a customer one time, and I may have shared this example on a previous episode, where they were basically repping pharmaceuticals to doctors, and they needed CRM. And I said, well, why do you think you need CRM? They said, because our competition has it. And I said, okay, well, what advantage does it give your competition? And essentially the answer was, I don't know, but they have it. I need it. Oh my goodness. Now, it was one of those situations where that customer really ultimately was not receptive to kind of that consultative approach. And of course, that gets into the niching and marketing and all and positioning and all of those things. But bottom line, I think it boils down to communication. That's where it's going to start. And I believe that through proper experimentation, I don't know a better word than to say it, but you just got to get your feet out there and get it wet and practice having value conversations. I think that's where it comes from. I found it interesting, you know, Edie was talking about these situations where, you know, you have a business where maybe, you know, the person who founded the firm is just this tremendous mind and has the ability to go in and see insights that nobody else can. And so putting together what I would call productized consulting, systems and processes and procedures that you have not only developed, but you have named, you've branded, and you can come in and say, we'll do this, and here's the result. Here's why you need this, right? In other words, taking the ability for that genius factor out, I think there's a balance. I think that's good, because what that does when you start to build that ladder, that product ladder underneath, is it elevates the value of that genius. And the whole purpose of the genius is to develop the intellectual capital of the business that you then turn into that product ladder. And so it's a system. How did you ever get the idea to do a chart of accounts review? Well, you did it one time, right? It started somewhere, and it's having an awareness to see through those things. So I kind of branched off from the communication side, going back to this area where I think a good, and I'm talking about even a solo firm can have this product ladder and still leave more room for the genius. Alan Weiss calls it the vault. There is a certain part of what you can offer that nobody else can offer. And that should always be the most expensive thing that you can sell, and only your best customers get it.
And exactly as you say, Kirk, before we do the consulting, before we do anything, before we take Edie's approach and follow a system, you have to have that conversation before. And you also must make a decision as a practitioner if you are going to work with the clients that are receptive to that conversation, or the ones that are not. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's a market for both. The ones that are not receptive to the value conversation, the ones that are not receptive to growth and advisory, or maybe they are, but they don't believe you are the person that they should have the conversation with. You've got to figure out, you have to look inward and say, you know, did I do a good enough job of establishing know, credibility or whatever that allow the customer to see me as that potential service provider, right? A provider of thought leadership, insight, foresight, everything that Edie's talking about. Or are they seeing me as a transition, as a means to an end, or some other minutia that they have to take care of? And you have to make that choice. As a consultant, as the advisor, you make that choice. You're like, I'm okay with volume over quality. I'm okay with just taking on customers and not getting involved or taking on the responsibility, not just financially, but emotionally. Because as Edie can tell you, I'm sure she's spoken to a lot of accountants that maybe the number one complaint is, this is very emotionally draining. Like for me to like get into the customer's dreams and intellect and potential and what they want, what they don't want, and cry with them and run with them and sweat with them, it's very emotionally draining. And most of us that went to school for some technical job or accounting, we were taught to work with machines and numbers and reports, and that's it. And we can give the report and run the hell away from the customer because everything else is just too much. And that's okay. And I don't think we're going to have a marketplace where every single accountant is a stupendous advisor. I don't think that will ever happen. I think that we will self-select ourselves out of that category or in that category. And there will be the data entry people, and there will be the people that push data, and there will be the people that convert data, and there'll be the people that present the financial statements, and the people that audit, and the people that do QuickBooks, and the people that don't. And there will be the folks that love to talk to customers, and people that, the ones that don't, and they all have a role in the system. But if you are the type of accountant or consultant that it's okay to submerge into this, into all the drama and all the emotional, potentially emotional draining aspects of getting involved with the client and having these deeper conversations than just the five things that you need. You know, to ask, sometimes you have to ask ridiculous things. You know, like Kirk and I were talking about, you know, just having a discussion with a client about taking vacations. You know, you talk to a client, a customer about taking vacations, and it sounds like small talk, but it's actually not, right? Because everyone that's in business likes to take a break. Everyone likes to take the profits and spend it on some cool gadget or spend it in their family or buy a bigger house or take a vacation. So there are aspects of the business owner's life that are heavily affected by the results of the business. And not understanding that, although it sounds like a personal thing, it's very difficult to connect with the client and say, let's have a deeper conversation about your numbers, about your employees, about your payroll, about the equipment that you're buying, about the building that you're trying to buy. Let's have deeper conversation about that and see how that aligns to, you know, the value that you're trying to extract from the business for your own personal life and for your own personal future. So it is extremely emotionally draining. And as Kirk says, you have to have those deep conversations beforehand. And before you implement any system, and I think Edie's system is great, and I'm sure it's not the only system out there. Everybody has a system to follow a process of some sort. Before you have a system, you have to have that mindset shift. You have to have that rapport with the client, and you have to create the environment of consultancy so nothing feels random. And Edie, you want to give us any last thoughts, or maybe something you didn't mention, maybe a comment to what Kirk said? And then lastly, just tell us how people can find out about you and what you do and your website and all that stuff.
Thank you. I would just add, this is my favorite sort of secret weapon in our toolkit. It's a question. And when a client tells you, it's a way to get to that intimacy point with them, to really get them to talk about what's happening in their business. When a client says, hey, having a hard time getting product out on time, a typical accountant would say, oh, well, good luck with that. Or what are you doing about that? Instead, I'd like you to have this question teed up in your mind. Is it a people or process issue? And this one question begins to unlock a whole layered approach to diving down to what's really happening in that business. And the client says, well, I think it's a people issue. Then you ask, does it happen all the time with all the people? If it does, then you know it's a process issue. Does it happen some of the time with some of the people? It's still a process issue. If it only happens when Hector's on duty, is that a people or process issue? And I would submit to you, it's still a process issue because either we didn't hire the right person, we didn't clarify what the role was, we aren't giving this person the training or the feedback they need to be more effective. We always default to process. And the reason for that is it's much easier to fix a process than to find, hire, and train a new person. Now, in the event we have a person issue, then now we have documented why they are not a good fit for our company. But that's one of the tools, the use of which will change the way you interact with your clients. Is it a people or process issue? Use it in your own firm. If you have a problem, something comes up in your firm, is it a people or process issue? More often than not, it is a process issue. We fix process. We give, and I love Kirk's terminology there, we give the genius a ladder to climb because the systems are there. So thank you so much for letting me sort of have this fun conversation with you guys. Obviously, you can tell I have a lot of energy for it. I've taught it a long time. And recently, I decided, given my age and stage in life, I'm done traveling. And so we launched our program online, primarily because I'm getting queries all over the world from having read my book, Firm Forward. And so that launched just a month ago, May 1st. And it is our entire 8-day training program online for self-study. And it includes all the training and tools and tutorials that I've barely alluded to here, but if you go to mentorplus.com, mentorplus.com, you'll see some brief videos that explain our process in more detail. You'll note that we've generated over $200 million in revenues for firms across North America that have followed our methodology, and that's just revenue for advisory services. The number for the clients increase is significantly greater than that. So I'm excited to have this topic be reaching its zenith. You know, when I first started teaching this, people were like, well, if I need to do advisory, and then it was, well, why should I do advisory? And a couple of years ago it was why now? And now everybody just is done with the why and why now, and it's how. How do I do this? How do I get this done? And that's where we're at. How do we get it done in an effective, fast manner so that you're not spending 5 years working out your own system? You know, my book, Firm Forward, spells it out pretty clearly, and that's a very low-end investment to be able to get your head wrapped around what a true, systematized, protocol-driven advisory process looks like. So thank you, and I hope people will come to the website. And if you send me an email, I will send you, anybody who hears this, the chart of accounts analysis, the tool that I spoke of earlier that will help you make your financial statements far more relevant to your clients. Just send that to edi@mentorplus.com.
Thank you so much, Edie. And coming from another person that loves to teach and train, congratulations on successfully converting something that you teach in person to some online, because I know that's a very difficult journey. It's a piece of you that you're giving up. Training and teaching in public, facilitating training in public has another level, has a level 5 type of satisfaction that you really can't draw anywhere else. But it is also a great thing where you create something valuable, not just within your circle or in your country, but in the world. Like this is what I've done with my YouTube videos. People email me from all over the world. And I do know that I can have that any of us can have a great lasting impact to anyone as long as we have a voice and we have the technology to deliver it. So although I would prefer to go, you know, maybe in an opportunity where you come back for a day or two to teach it live, to show up to a live one that online, I do recommend folks that don't have the capacity to physically go see you speak in person to do something like that. So Kirk, how about you? You got any last words?
Hector, I'm just looking forward to seeing some of our friends live and in person at Scaling New Heights here in just under 3 weeks. I know we're both going to be doing the very topics we were discussing on the show.
Absolutely. Thank you, Kirk. Thank you, Edie. And I'll see you next week.